From the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. When you think of humanitarian crises, they're usually caused by war or some natural disaster, like a drought or earthquake. But in Venezuela today, millions of people face shortages of food and medicines for a very different reason, the spectacular mismanagement of its economy. By one estimate, Venezuelans spend an average of 35 hours a month standing in lines to buy food. Surgeons lack anesthesia, and according to Bloomberg News, new car and truck sales in the country have declined by 99% since 2007. All of this has led to some big protests against President Nicolas Maduro's government. Maduro, of course, took over after the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013. But his popularity has plunged, and the opposition is trying to gather enough signatures to recall him from office. To talk more about this man-made crisis, we're going to start with John Otis, a correspondent for NPR in Bogota, Colombia. He was recently kicked out of Venezuela by the government. John, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks, Jason. Nice to be here.
So tell us, I understand you've covered Venezuela for about 20 years. Give us just a snapshot of how life has changed there.
Yeah, it's undergone a very dramatic change. My first times in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez was a candidate, and he was a candidate for the Socialist Party, and there was a lot of optimism and hope that his socialist policies would kind of bring a new bonanza to Venezuela. And for a while, things seemed to be working, in part because oil prices were so high. But a combination of just terrible mismanagement by the government, a plunge in oil prices, has really brought disaster upon upon Venezuela. And now what you have are Venezuelans streaming across the border into Colombia to buy food. You've got massive food shortages because the government hasn't, doesn't have enough income to import food and other products. And so you've got the government's popularity has fallen, and so now the opposition is trying to get rid of current President Nicolas Maduro through a recall referendum, and the government's trying to stop that, so that's causing even more unrest, and that's another reason why you've got all these big political protests happening in Venezuela right now.
And tell us just a little bit more about this recall referendum. How likely is it to be successful? What's sort of the timeline for this to happen, if it is going to happen?
Well, a lot of people say with the Maduro government, it's more a matter of when the government's going to fall now rather than if. And the opposition would like to do this peacefully through a recall referendum. And they're gathering signatures, and they're trying to get this recall referendum to be held this year. And timing's a very key point, because if it's held this year, President Maduro is almost sure to lose, and then there would be a new elections, and the opposition would have a very good chance to take power for the first time in 17 years. But the electoral authorities, who are basically under the thumb of the executive branch, are dragging their feet. They're trying to delay this recall until next year. And if that happens and President Maduro loses, which is very probable, then his handpicked vice president would take over and the socialists would remain in power and this political crisis would continue.
And one thing you've talked about in the past is the effect of sort of a brain drain on the Venezuelan economy. What's going on there? Why are smart people leaving the country?
Yeah, I mean, because, for example, I was at one of the Caracas hospitals, and very highly skilled doctors are earning, the equivalent of 50, 80 bucks a month, because the local currency has collapsed. PhDs at Central University in Venezuela are earning, $40, $50 a month, again, because the economy has collapsed and the currency has collapsed. So thousands and thousands of very highly qualified Venezuelans are fleeing to the United States, here to Colombia, to other South American countries to look for work. And, that's a terrible thing for Venezuela, because once they start recovering from this crisis, they're going to have this brain drain they're going to have to deal with. They're going to have to lure these people back.
And what about this phenomenon of people spending hours and hours every week waiting in line to buy food, to buy other basic goods? How does that affect people's lives?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons, for example, that the protests that the opposition has been having, they haven't been quite as massive as you might think, because people have to spend so much of their time, horsing around looking for food, standing in lines at grocery stores, trying to go out and buy things on the black market. The socialist government put in place price controls and you know their theories that this is going to help the poor people. But the problem is a lot. For example, a pound of spaghetti or a pound of rice will be sold for just a few cents in the grocery stores, and that's lower than the cost of production. So that just drives down productivity in the countryside and exacerbates the food shortages. And you also have a problem of smugglers smuggling cheap food across into Colombia and selling it at big markup prices, and black marketeers selling this cheap food at very high prices. So your option in Venezuela often is to either go without the food because you can't find it, or to look for it on the black market and pay very high prices.
And what about the role of the media during the recent crisis? Now, I understand you were kicked out of Venezuela with some other foreign journalists. And there have been some reports the government has been pressuring sort of opposition independent media outlets into closing or selling themselves to pro-government people. What's going on?
Yeah, there's the government has become increasingly authoritarian, and they've got very thin skin. They don't like any sort of criticism. So what's happened is that they've used, they don't use kind of the old-fashioned type of censorship where you send in the army to close down the newspaper. What they'll do is they'll fine radio and TV stations. They'll cancel their broadcasting licenses. There's a newsprint shortage. That's another product that Venezuela has to import, and the government doesn't really care about newspapers publishing, so they haven't been importing much newsprint. So many newspapers around the country just don't print anymore. If they're lucky, they still have an online version. El Nacional, which is sort of like, I guess, the equivalent of the New York Times or the Washington Post in Caracas, that's just a very thin little paper now. It used to be thick and fat, especially the Sunday edition. Now I think it's down to 16 pages.
And how is the United States perceived in Venezuela right now? I understand one member of Maduro's government has accused President Obama of sending an organized mafia to Venezuela to buy up food, keep it out of the hands of Venezuelans. Is the U.S., is it viewed as a threat or as an adversary to people in Venezuela?
Well, the Venezuelan government obviously paints the United States that way. They're trying to blame most of their problems on either the United States or what they call as foreign aggression or, opposition, an unloyal opposition trying to sabotage the government, when, they really should be looking at themselves and their own policies, which have just been a disaster. Myself as an American going into Venezuela, if you go to a rally of pro-Chavez or pro-government people, you might catch a few snide remarks, but overall, I haven't had much of a problem reporting from Venezuela for the past 20 years.
John Otis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about Venezuela's downward spiral into economic and political crisis. We're going to bring in three other people who have spent years researching Venezuela now. Joining us from Durham, North Carolina, is Patrick Duddy. He was U.S. ambassador to Venezuela from 2007 to 2010. He's now director of the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at Duke University. Also joining us from Tucson, Arizona, is Jennifer Sear. She's a professor of government and Latin American studies at the University of Arizona. And from Albany, New York, by Gabriel Hetland. He's a professor of Latin American studies at SUNY Albany. His article, Why is Venezuela in Crisis?, was published in The Nation last month. Welcome to all of you. Patrick Duddy, I want to start with you. Give us your viewpoint here first. Venezuela has the largest proved oil reserves in the world. How did it get to the point of triple-digit inflation and an economy forecast to shrink by 8% this year?
Well, it was a complex process, but I think you have to start with the attempt by first Maduro and now continued by first by Chavez, continued by Maduro, to radically change the economic system and at the same time use the oil rents, that is to say the revenue from their immense reserves, to underwrite a range of social programs that have proven to be extremely expensive and unsustainable. Now, the consequence of some of those efforts was that the country simply didn't make the capital investments in the all-important oil sector. And so they have very little ability to increase production. And in fact, production is now lower than it was when Chavez took office. At the same time, their efforts to transform the economy have effectively spiked virtually every other productive sector, and the country has become increasingly dependent on an oil sector which is underfunded and seeing a decline in its productivity. So when you combine the increasing dependence with declining production in that sector and precipitous declines of production in every other center with a drop in global oil prices, you have all of the necessary components for an economic crisis in Venezuela.
And Jennifer Sear in Arizona, tell us about the opposition to President Maduro. I understand this is something that you research. They did take control of parliament in elections last year. What have they been able to accomplish?
Yeah, so the opposition has worked very diligently to try to push back against the increasingly authoritarian tendencies of Hugo Chavez. But really, from the beginning, they tried multiple different ways to push back against his popularity. And so early on, the opposition, I think we can say now with hindsight, attempted through extra-constitutional means to remove Chavez from power, famously a coup in 2002. They shut down the oil industry, which early on was controlled by the opposition and by unions that supported the opposition. But as that didn't work, and in fact sort of these efforts actually strengthened Chavez's popularity, they returned to a more electoral channels. And today I would say the opposition is more institutionalized than it's ever been before. There is what is called the Mesa de la Unidad Democrática, the Democratic Unity Roundtable, which brings together multiple different political parties who share the same goal of providing some sort of counter to Chavismo in government. Now, the problem is that this opposition is, because it's, you know, by definition made up of multiple political parties, it's highly fragmented. So there are multiple parties that espouse very different ideological positions. Recently, we've had some tactical divisions. So on the one hand, you have one part of the opposition and one part of the MUD, the MUD, that's what they call it, the MUD, wanting to, again, count Chavismo via electoral channels, and another part of the opposition that publicly sort of separated itself from this electoral group seeking to remove Chavez from power via pressures in the streets. So you have ideological differences, you have tactical differences, and you even have some leadership concerns where you have the face of the opposition, Enrique Capriles, who's been the opposition's candidate for the presidency in the last few electoral races, now having to compete against Henry Ramos, who has become the president of the National Assembly. Now, he is an interesting figure because he is the leader of the Democratic Action Party, Acción Democrática, which is one of the political parties from the previous political party system that essentially collapsed when Chavez comes to power.
So there's, in other words, it sounds like there's some fairly widespread divisions then amongst the opposition at this point. And I want to continue on this vein in a moment, but I want to turn this to Gabriel Hetland then, because you visited Venezuela recently and you came away with the impression that the U.S. media has overstated the extent of the crisis there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'd agree with the other guests that there's no doubt Venezuela is in the midst of a very severe and unfortunately deep and worsening crisis. But I think a few components of the mainstream media narrative that we hear repeatedly need to be pushed back against a little bit. The first is the idea that Venezuela is in a sort of apocalyptic catastrophe. When I was down there in June and spoke to, you know, dozens of people in multiple states in the country, many people were suffering without a doubt, but a lot of folks told me that they're eating still three meals a day. Other folks said that they were eating two meals a day. So I think you also want to push back against the government narrative that there's no crisis. So a sort of middle point is where I would go in terms of the severity. And I do think it's gotten worse over time, although some friends have recently told me it's getting better. So we'll have to see. But then in terms of the sort of picture of the opposition, I think we also need to push back against that in certain ways. And I'm glad that Jennifer raised the 2002 coup, because frequently we hear about the opposition being totally committed to peaceful change, but in 2002, they supported a violent coup that overthrew Hugo Chavez for 47 hours. And unfortunately, that violent past is not completely historical. In April of 2013, we saw violent opposition protests which targeted government-run health centers and resulted in at least 7 civilians dying. Then in February 2014, we saw months of opposition-led protests where 43 people died. Approximately half of those were due to opposition activists, and then the other half were due to the government. So no doubt the government deserves a lot of criticism for acts of repression and for really mismanaging the economy. But I think we do need to sort of have a more balanced picture of the opposition itself. And then in terms of the opposition's role in the economic crisis, I think that they've been getting off a little too scot-free. All of this sort of violent protests, which again is not so much in the past. Ramos the other day actually sort of celebrated the 2002 coup. This is on August 27th, just days before the big September 1st march. And he actually said, you know, the worst thing about it was that it didn't succeed. So that's not exactly somebody who seems to be totally committed to peaceful means.
Well, Gabriel, let me stop you there, because you do raise this issue of the role of the military in Venezuelan politics. And you referenced the coup back in 2002. And Patrick Duddy, if I could bring you in now, talk to us about the role of the military in Venezuelan politics. What sort of role are they playing now? Hugo Chavez had been an officer and had the support of the army. Is that the case now in Venezuela?
First of all, Chavez obviously did come from the military, and he and others in the military attempted a coup in 1992, which failed, and following which he was sentenced to a prison term, later commuted. The military in 2002 essentially removed him for power for about 2 days, but also subsequently restored him following the civilian leadership's decision to, among other things, dissolve the legislature at the time, which clearly startled the military and suggested the new government would go in the wrong direction. Since that time, the military has played an increasingly prominent part in governing the country. And while it is widely believed that the military is not monolithic, first Chavez and now increasingly Maduro have turned to the military to try and to get them to help solve some of the problems with the government's mismanagement of the economy. Very specifically, he asked the general Padrino López to take over the problem, to take on the problem of food distribution, and rather amazingly, following the indictment of the former drug czar, General Nestor Reverol, Maduro appointed Reverol as Minister of the Interior. The actions of the government would suggest that the military is at the highest levels. Is playing a very central role in governing the country. And clearly, President Maduro both leans on them for support vis-a-vis the opposition, but also has turned to them because so many elements of the Chavez government have failed to successfully address the accumulating problems that the government is facing.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking about the crisis in Venezuela today. We're joined by Patrick Duddy, a former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, also by Jennifer Sear of the University of Arizona and Gabriel Hetland of SUNY Albany. If you want more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and articles about undercover places and issues. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. Jennifer Sear, I want to turn back to you now. I was hoping you'd tell us a bit about how the Venezuelan government and the opposition are relating to each other right now, given this sort of history of coup d'etats. Is there dialogue, or is it just simply pure hostility at this point?
Yeah, you know, I think there's sort of two things going on simultaneously. So on the one hand, you have both the government and the opposition pressuring each other. The government is currently, particularly Maduro and the executive, has relied on a very friendly, Chavista-friendly judiciary to expand executive powers and stymie the efforts at legislative reform by the part of the now opposition-controlled National Assembly. And meantime, the opposition is, you know, in the streets, sometimes violently, as Gabriel, I think, correctly pointed out, pressuring the government on a regular basis. So in that sense, there's a real lack of trust on both sides. But while that's going on, there's also this effort at dialogue to try to find a peaceful resolution to move past the impasse. They've brought in the former Spanish Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, to be the mediator between the two sides. They're trying to sit down and come to some sort of agreement in terms of if there's going to be a recall referendum, if it will take place in 2016, 2017, there's some negotiations going on there from what I understand. But again, sort of there's this real problem of trust on both sides because there was these sort of dual things happening where they're sitting at the table on the one hand, but they're also pressuring each other from the outside, undoubtedly trying to get leverage at the negotiating table or at the dialogue table, I should say.
And Gabriel Hetland, I wanted to ask you about the role of the United States in this, because the government has blamed a number of its problems on the United States, on the Obama administration. How, in your view, has the U.S. contributed to Venezuela's problems, if at all?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a really important issue to get at. On the one hand, I don't think that the U.S. can be completely blamed for Venezuela's problems. So clearly the government is exaggerating using those claims, and they're sort of using that to deflect attention from their own errors. So it's important to state that. On the other hand, the U.S. does play an unfortunate role in making the crisis worse. For over a decade, the U.S. has sort of openly and in more hidden ways supported the opposition, sometimes supporting the violent opposition. And there's documents suggesting a role in the 2002 coup and in other sort of instances of opposition violence. The most recent instances are the U.S. declaring Venezuela an extraordinary national security threat. That happened first in March 2015, and then it was renewed by President Obama this year in March. And when that first happened, it's really interesting because the opposition actually came out and said, we are not a security threat to anyone. That's not the government, but the opposition of Venezuela. So the particular effect of that is relatively limited. It just provides sanctions on a few officials, but it also sends a signal to investors in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere, and to bankers saying, this is not a safe country to invest in. This is on the U.S. sort of watch list. Don't do business there. And I've heard from friends with knowledge of Venezuela as well, saying that they've talked to bankers in the U.S. and Europe who've been specifically asked by the U.S. government not to do business with Venezuela. So the U.S. claims to be sort of supporting the Venezuelan people, but unfortunately, some of the U.S.'s actions, both public and private, have undoubtedly made the crisis much worse. And so I think that is something that has to be part of the story.
Well, Patrick Duddy, let me go ahead and respond to that.
If I may just jump in on a couple of points. There are a number of things that haven't been mentioned today, which I think are important to take into account. First of all, groups like the Inter-American Human Rights Commission and Human Rights Watch have regularly and increasingly expressed their concern about the human rights environment in Venezuela and have really very specifically identified the government as the source of the vast bulk of the egregious violations of human rights. The sanctions that were announced and subsequently adopted by the United States literally focused on seven individuals, individuals who, it said, were being sanctioned either for undermining democracy or for committing egregious human rights violations or substantial acts of corruption. Most recently, and I think very significantly, you know, we've heard expressions of concern from the United States, but one of the things that I know is that the United States has never stopped doing business with Venezuela, and that means with the government of Venezuela through PDVSA. We remain their largest market.
That's their largest market for oil, correct?
Yeah, well, and that's virtually the only thing they export anymore. 97% of all export earnings come from oil, and the U.S. is their largest market, and even a more important contributor to their cash flow, because Oil that is sold to some of their Caribbean partners is deeply discounted, and concessionary financing is offered, and some of the oil they send to China is used to amortize their debt to China. And so neither of those two markets provide the same sort of cash flow that the market from in the United States does. The other thing that I would emphasize, though, aside from the very deep concerns expressed by the Human Rights Watch and the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, by the United Nations Human Rights Commission and others, is that now even a number of the major allies supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution to date, like the countries of the Southern Common Market known as the Mercosur, have expressed their concern for the erosion of democracy, the rising authoritarianism of the government, and the deterioration of human rights. Just this week, the countries of the Mercosur, that is Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay, announced that, number one, their fifth member of the group, Venezuela, would not be allowed to hold the rotating presidency of the group, and that if they do not begin to meet their commitments to the group, including their commitments on democracy and human rights, that Venezuela would be suspended sometime in December. This is actually an extraordinary change within the region.
Well, Patrick, our time does grow short, so I want to give the last word to Jennifer Sear here. Jennifer, what are some possible short-term and long-term scenarios here for Venezuela's crisis? How does this look like it's going to end? We have just about a minute to go.
Yeah, well, I think there's a consensus on all parts that, from what I understand, there's a consensus that everybody wants this to end peacefully. Everybody wants a stable transition. The dialogue is one option. The referendum is another option. But I also feel sort of compelled to raise one more point as well, and that has to do with sort of the real victims here are the Venezuelan citizens, right? They elected into office in 1998, a very popular figure. He remained popular over 50% of the vote in four different presidential elections, right? So, you know, there is exhaustion over this political system today, but there was exhaustion that brought him to power from the two-party system that led, you know, for 40 years. It became highly exclusive, extremely corrupt. And so the opposition today in some ways reflects that two-party system of the past. And so the real problem today is that Venezuelans aren't really excited or even supportive of Chavismo as much anymore, but the opposition is not a happy alternative. And so this impasse does need to be resolved, and there has to be some sort of happy alternative that most Venezuelan citizens can get behind.
I'm sorry, Jennifer, we're just out of time. We're going to have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA. Many thanks to John Otis, Patrick Duddy, Jennifer Sear, and Gabriel Hetland for joining us. Our assistant producers this week were Anna Suter, Thomas Orihuela, Federico Maccioni, and Jonah McCown. Our studio producers are Vera Tan and Alyssa Blyle. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.